From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, accusations fly as legislative leaders dig in on the remaining issues in the 2017 legislative session. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on his conversation with Republican Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. And a group that counts seven Hudson Valley counties as its members receives funding to continue work in food rescue and combating food insecurity. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Legislative leaders have dug in on the remaining issues in the 2017 session and are accusing each other of unfairly linking unrelated items to renewal of mayoral control over New York City schools. As the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports, time is running out for scheduled meetings.
One of the few items that faces a hard deadline is the renewal of mayoral control of the New York City schools. It expires at the end of the month. Senate Republican Majority Leader John Flanagan, who along with his GOP members has released three different bills, says he supports the concept and believes something can get done in the next few days before the session is scheduled to end.
Number one, we believe in mayoral control. Number two, as we did in the budget, and between now and June 21st, we will do the people's business.
All of the Senate's bills on mayoral control include provisions to strengthen charter schools, which Flanagan says are an integral part of the public school system.
Let's be clear. By law, charter schools are public schools.
During debate on the Senate floor, Senator Brad Hoylman, a Democrat, says linking the two items are a diversion and that lawmakers should be cautious that they don't siphon off resources.
In some instances, they are a shoehorn to the privatization of our public education system.
Senator Hoylman attempted to link the Republican state senator's proposals to the action of President Trump's administration and his education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who favors school vouchers.
Where we are giving up on our public education in favor of privatization.
Senator Flanagan, who was formerly the chamber's education committee chair, defended the bill. He denies it has anything to do with Republicans in Washington.
Honestly, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. I'm the architect of this legislation. The only thing I care about is what's going on in the state of New York. I'm not guided by what's happening in Washington. I'm guided by what's happening here.
Democrats are in the minority in the Senate, but they control the state assembly. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie also opposes linking the extension of mayoral control to sweeteners for charter schools, and he's already called the Senate bills a non-starter. He accused the Senate of stonewalling.
If I'm told the only way that we're going to get mayoral control is I have to do something on charter schools, they're the ones who said they're not ready to negotiate.
The assembly bill to renew mayoral control is also linked to a seemingly unrelated item, a provision to allow counties in upstate and on Long Island to keep charging sales tax. Senator Flanagan says assembly Democrats are being hypocritical. He says at least the Senate bills are all related to education matters.
They have decided to take a different tack and hold hostage a number of our colleagues right here for revenue in their local communities. If they had said at the beginning, no linkage, and stayed to that, that would be a different story.
Assembly Speaker Hastie says he believes the two measures are related because they all deal with requests from localities, including the city of New York and county governments across the state, and so they should be linked.
I look at it as respecting every single county's wish.
But the speaker says he is discussing mayoral control and the sales tax renewals with the Senate and Governor Cuomo. Senator Flanagan concurs that talks are going on behind the scenes as the countdown to the end of the session continues. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Well, Alan, the NBC New York Marist poll on the election for governor has Governor Andrew Cuomo beating his potential Republican challengers by more than 2-1. Even among voters who are registered Republicans, 22% approve the governor's job performance. That includes Donald Trump Jr. in the mix. And, of course, you spoke with the Republican minority leader of the Assembly, Brian Kolb. He's disqualifying the polls and says they can beat the governor in a reelection fight.
Well, yes. I mean, anything can happen. Things can turn fast. We've seen it in England with both Brexit and with the stunning losses by Theresa May, the prime minister. Things can happen. They can happen fast. Look, there are a number of things that are coming up that we're going to have to keep our eyes on. Number one is the trial of all of Cuomo's ex-associates who are very, very close to him. And there will be testimony. We know at least one of them has turned. And we don't know what he's going to say. We don't know what Joe Prococo, who is the main person who is on trial here and was described as the governor by the governor as his third brother, we don't know what he's going to say in order to stay out of jail and perhaps keep his wife out of jail. So there are a lot of people who are holding their breath on that one. Secondly, there is no candidate yet. There's some potential candidates, and they're awful. In New York State, can you imagine with Trump's popularity where it is, there's been whispers that his son might run against Cuomo. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. The other thing is Cuomo has a ton of money. The last time I looked, it was something like 25, 27 million. Don't hold me to the exact amount in his campaign chest. And he's going for more. So that is going to be, of course, a huge plus for the governor. Though those who have money can really do extremely well, saturate the airwaves and all the rest. So I think that what you're seeing now is a result of all of that. The governor has changed his ways. He's proving whether character can change or not. He's proving that he understands where his downsides were, and his new crew that is surrounding him are doing very well by him. And he's gaining traction as a result of that. So the old arrogance, which was so apparent to so many people, is not quite as on display as it once was. Therefore, he's doing very well. But things can change. Do I think that they will? No. I think he's going to be reelected governor, and he's going to run for president.
We're coming down to the end of session, just over a week, and one of the items on the agenda, another thing you spoke to the Republican Minority Leader Kolb about, was procurement reform, and that is tied to the issue of pay-to-play in some of these investigations and, of course, the state comptroller.
Yes. The state controller, of course, has been sadly and badly dissed by this governor. He took away, with the legislature's approval, the power to pre-audit some of the state's contracts with some of the not-for-profits. That is what led to the trial I was speaking of just a few seconds ago. So can we see a direct cause? No. I mean, do we know that if his pre-audit function had not been taken away from the controller, he would have spotted all of this nonsense and this thievery that people have been accused of? Maybe, maybe not. But why would you take away powers from a constitutionally authorized person like the controller of the state of New York? Why would you do that? And then say, after your friends got caught or put on trial, what do you say? Okay, yeah, we got to do more. So you appoint people who will check on other people, but they will report not to the people of New York, not to the Constitution, which has an elected controller, but to yourself. So now he's putting these inspector generals. It's a disgrace. But he's doing it.
And of course, all eyes on Alexandria after Representative Steve Scalise and four other people were shot on a baseball field where members of a congressional team were practicing for a charity game, which will go on at the Nationals Field today, Alan. But there was a reaction from Western New York Congressman Chris Collins after this, basically going after the Democrats and saying, I hope they can tone down the rhetoric. Says he has a pistol permit and will start carrying a gun when he's out and about. But what about that, saying that the discourse fuels fires?
Well, yeah. Look, there is no question that things are very, very tense. We can say who hit John first. My impression is that much of this tension comes directly to the door of POTUS, or the President of the United States, who has said the most ridiculous and crazy things, tweeting them out all over the place, when he lost the popular vote, which I have said so many times, and yet he becomes a climate denier, that he is threatening to take away the health care of, he described that bill that first came out of the House of Representatives as a great bill. Now it's a mean bill. Nothing means anything. So let me just say, if you're taking health care away from 24 million people, that's a fairly mean thing to be doing. And he knows it. I think they're leaning on him about this stuff. He's left all of those people like John Faso and Lee Stefanik out swinging in the wind. They all supported him. They did what he wanted them to do. And now he is leaving them out there calling them mean. It's an extraordinary story. So please, Mr. Collins, don't tell me that it's the Democrats who have started this thing. Yeah, this guy may have been an unbalanced person and he may be a Democrat, but it could have gone either way and has gone either way, if you look at the kind of history of terrorism in this country, guys like McVeigh and others. So, you know, that while I don't know who was what, I can tell you there are an awful lot of unbalanced people in this country, and they have access to guns, and that's what this is all about.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gistina. A group that counts seven Hudson Valley counties as its members has received New York State funding to continue its work in food rescue and combating food insecurity. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn reports.
Rich Schaffo is senior planner with the Newburgh-based Hudson Valley Regional Council, which is the recipient of a $20,000 grant from New York State.
And the money is going towards bringing awareness to need to reduce food waste and the bounty of food that we have here in the Hudson Valley and the need to feed people.
It all culminates in October with an event on the Poughkeepsie side of Pedestrian Bridge Walkway over the Hudson called Feeding the Hudson Valley, for which the council and its partners prepare and serve a free meal of recovered food from the following sources.
So all food that we have gleaned from local farms or had donated from local farms that would have otherwise gone to waste. So it's food that farmers could not potentially market, whether they're misshapen tomatoes or just too much of a particular crop, too much eggplant, too many peppers, too small, too big, whatever, for whatever reason they can't market, as well as going to local other local markets.
At last year's inaugural event, the Hudson Valley Regional Council and its partners rescued more than 3,000 pounds of food, providing more than 1,400 free meals, 800 of which were donated to area food agencies. One of the Hudson Valley Regional Council's many partners is Kingston-based Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency, where Merlin Akhtar is recycling coordinator.
So a lot of it is just education, you know, showing, part of the events is just showing people like how many people you can feed with all that food that might have just gone in the garbage. It's good food, healthy food, that we can feed the people right where we live.
Again, Schaffo.
We have a tremendous amount of food waste in this country. 40% of the food that we grow in this country goes uneaten. And then we have a food insecurity problem where we have about 1 in 7 people that do not have enough food, particularly over the summer.
Both Schaffo and Akhtar say transportation and storage are two key issues, getting the rescue food to those who need it. Akhtar says coordination needs attention, and food pantries can be hard-pressed to access and or store produce.
You know, it needs to be kind of a cold storage, and that's a big issue for a lot of people. It's who's open. You know, the person who has the extra food may be open, but the person who can take it is not open. So there's a lot of coordination of who can go pick it up. Is there someone there to receive it? Trying to match donors with receivers. And then on the other end is also just educating people. There might be people who have extra food who don't know that there's an outlet for it to go somewhere. And so they just end up throwing it out, even though they know that, hey, I should be doing something with this, but I just don't know where to go or where to turn.
Since the first Feeding the Hudson Valley event, Schaffo says there is growing awareness and a positive development.
One good thing since past October is that in this year's New York State budget, there was an approval for farmers to be able to now take a tax credit on their state taxes. There has been a federal tax credit for farmers to donate excess produce. Now there is a state tax credit which is a little more incentive for farmers to be able to donate.
The Hudson Valley Regional Council is one of 10 organizations to get a grant from the New York State Pollution Prevention Institute, which is sponsored by the State Department of Environmental Conservation. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
As several communities across New York deal with water pollution issues, the Rensselaer County Village of Hoosick Falls has hired a renowned environmental attorney for representation as it negotiates with the companies deemed responsible for polluting water supplies. In the meantime, efforts to study the chemical PFOA in New York and southern Vermont has gotten a boost from a federal grant. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard explains.
After Hoosick Falls Mayor Rob Allen was elected in March, one of the first moves of the village board was to part ways with a legal firm that had negotiated two failed settlement agreements with polluters Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics and Honeywell, the companies deemed responsible for polluting water supplies with the chemical PFOA. This week, the village voted to hire Albany-based environmental attorney David Engel. Allen said Engel brings a wealth of experience. He represented the town of Half Moon when it successfully secured a $5.6 million drinking water settlement with General Electric over costs related to the PCB contamination of the Hudson River. Working with the group Healthy Hoosick Water, Engel has been a vocal opponent of the village's past settlement proposals. Here's Mayor Allen.
So he brings a lot of experience in terms of the environmental side of it and also a lot of understanding about PFOA.
Engel said his work begins with reviewing the past communication between the village and companies and the actions of the law firm formerly retained by the village.
We're going to have to do some work and go back and review the full record as to what transpired sort of transactionally between the companies and the village's prior counsel and see how it was that the thing went so badly off the tracks.
Ultimately, Engel warned, the village is prepared to pursue the matter in court. Allen cautioned an individual could potentially sue the village because it was the village that provided the polluted water.
For myself, the first priority is the village needs to be protected, and the settlement did not give that. It gave us the right to seek being protected through indemnification, but that doesn't actually mean you have indemnification. So I thought that really any settlement has to start with that very first simple step.
According to Engel, negotiations will have to take into consideration numerous future scenarios related to pollution.
And, you know, we live in a litigious society. We live in litigious times. Who knows what's lurking out there in terms of possible claims?
Engel said the former village landfill should be considered in future negotiations.
And it turns out that that's heavily contaminated with PFOA waste. The leachate coming out of that landfill has high levels of PFOA. A nearby pond has high levels of PFOA. That undoubtedly is going to require a further response.
The study of PFOA in upstate New York and across the border in southern Vermont is getting a boost. Bennington College has been awarded a $300,000 grant to continue its studies. The award from the National Science Foundation to faculty members David Bond, Janet Foley, and Tim Schroeder will expand the work for three more years. Bond says the ability to study contamination issues across state boundaries is unique.
So we're not only researching PFOA in New York and Vermont and the impacted communities there, but we're also trying to provide a forum for those communities to talk to one another, engage with one another, and also learn from one another.
A PFOA summit was recently held on the Bennington campus. The grant will also allow Union College in Schenectady to come on as a research partner. Laura McManus Spencer, a chemistry professor at Union, has studied PFOA for a decade. She said the partnership will allow Union students to obtain real-world experience in the classroom and also meet and communicate with people affected by contamination.
You know, that we're not just sort of holed up in a lab somewhere doing these analyses and then spitting out these scientific reports that don't mean anything to anyone, but really helping the community members to understand what the results mean.
For more WAMC stories on water contamination in New York and Vermont, visit WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada has been in effect for more than two decades. President Donald Trump, meanwhile, has promised to renegotiate the deal. During a recent business expo in Plattsburgh, the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley discovered that many businesses in the border region aren't worried about the pending negotiations.
From makeup to manufacturing, tourism to technology, and bankers to broadcasters, more than 200 businesses exhibited their wares and attended a supply chain management summit at the 29th Annual Business Expo on Thursday. With the border about 30 miles away, many have Canadian trade ties or are branches of a Canadian-based business.
We're owned by Volvo, and Volvo did not have a presence really in the United States. So Volvo wanted to build a factory to have a U.S. presence, and that's why Volvo basically picked Plattsburgh. And ever since then, it's been a successful journey.
Joey Varon is the human resources business partner for Nova Bus Prevo, Quebec-based subsidiaries of Volvo. The manufacturing plants are located in the town of Plattsburgh, which he says gives them a better competitive position in the U.S. Varon says at the plant level, NAFTA renegotiations are not an issue.
If there was concern, we're not hearing it at our level. It's probably staying up at the corporate level, probably through Canada and Sweden. And we haven't heard anything that's filtered down to our level yet. So to us, it's business as usual, and we're just going to keep putting out those buses.
Rose Computer's account manager, Michael Page, is based in South Burlington, Vermont. He does a lot of his tech work remotely. He's taking a wait-and-see position with any plan from the president.
He changes his mind all the time. So when he says he's going to do something, until he actually does it, I'm not going to badmouth him. He's got enough problems. But I can tell you this, and these are facts, the tech industry is going to be short 2 million people. So companies like ours are an absolute must. The manufacturing sector is going to be short 2 million people. I just don't think he's going to be able to do all these things that he says he's going to. So I'll see what happens.
Imperial Industrial Park property manager Doug Buttdorf notes his tenants come from across the U.S., Montreal, and China.
When I talk with our tenants, the discussion often lends itself to what is the trajectory of the federal policies. And everyone's standing pat right now. But I do believe there is some action and some preparations being made by our tenants and the businesses that do business here in anticipation of some potential changes. But under the Obama administration, there was a lot of potential changes that were coming under the HR front. There's a lot of changes all the time in the world of regulation of business. I don't see panic from any of our tenants, from any of our international trade friends, from any of our local employees. The only panic I really see is how can I get educated fast enough so that I can participate in the new manufacturing economy?
Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas says the general attitude of business on both sides of the border toward a NAFTA renegotiation is not alarmist.
There are updates that can be made. There are ways to enhance it. There are things to be added to it that 20 years ago weren't really thought of as essential to global business. So actually, most people are approaching it, particularly our Canadian friends, from a very positive environment and realizing that most of that angst is directed at the U.S.-Mexican relationship.
In mid-May, the U.S. Trade Representative formally informed Congress of President Trump's intent to begin renegotiating the NAFTA agreement with Canada and Mexico.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1724. Or just podcast on the web at wamcpodcasts.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.